You okay, Rina? You seem stressed. What's going on?
Do you ever feel that parenting a disabled child is chaos, like absolute paperwork chaos? There's just so much admin on top of caring for your kids. It's like I'm my freaking daughter's PA.
Ah, yes. You should try the new Hibi app.
An app?
Not just any app, it's Disabled Parenting Mega PA organization. So you can schedule appointments, have reminders for your medication, have all of their medical notes and letters in just one place.
Hang on, spell this out to me again.
Hibi, Hibi. It's a disabled parenting organization app. I wish I'd had it when B was younger. It gives me a sense of control over, well, the uncontrollable.
Sounds intriguing. Who doesn't want to organize disabled parenting chaos one notification at a time?
Haha, yes, it's my new sidekick. Sidekicking the shit out of disabled parenting organization.
That's the least catchy strapline I've ever heard, Lauren.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. They won't want it. But if you, like Rena and I, want to give it a go, you can download Hibi for free on the App Store now. Since recording this episode, Rachel's father has sadly passed. Our love and heartfelt condolences to Rachel and her whole family. Please do visit Dementia UK if you would like to make a donation in his memory. All my
Today, we're talking to Rachel Pierce on sandwich caring and the challenges that she's faced as an only child when both her parents began to get older and more frail. At the same time as that, her daughter was also being diagnosed with a genetic condition.
Yeah, she really got catapulted into being this carer for three people, which, as she described it, was extremely challenging and it led to her actually having proper carer burnout. It really got me thinking about how much we will have similar potential challenges coming down the line. They talk about the sandwich generation of parents of dependent children who also then look after ailing or elderly parents. And, in our case, those dependent children are going to be dependent beyond childhood and have needs for much longer. So it's something that we probably, if we're not already dealing with, probably have to prepare ourselves for. I'm definitely guilty of wanting to take on too much, mostly because I'm a total control freak and I want to be in control of everything. So I think some of the things that we talked about with Rachel, like asking for help and thinking about ourselves in that scenario, is quite key.
Yeah, agree. It was really interesting and it made me think about my own mum and my mother-in-law, actually, because both of them have parents who are getting to that stage where, they're needing more help, but with the added pressure of not living in the UK. And then that has an impact on my life because both of them I rely on for respite and babysitting duties and all of those
Yeah.
things. Really, really interesting. And I didn't look at it as sandwich caring until our conversation with Rachel.
Yeah.
And people do it so automatically without actually realizing what it is that they're doing.
Some people don't define it as caring, I guess. And traditionally, people would look after family. It's like that's what you do. You look after the old as they get older, and you look after the children. I think it just as often is the case. There's this additional intensity and this additional dimension when the care needs of your children or your dependents are so significant. We also look after Patrick's mom occasionally. We are not by any means her like primary carer. That's done by his brother and sister in Ireland, but she has dementia and needs full-time carers. And we would have her over for like a fortnight at a time and take on that care and responsibility, which it's not easy, like managing somebody elderly full time and then also having your children to care for and look after it. But then there is overlap and parallels.
Well, it's that Benjamin Button thing, isn't it? Like they revert back to those childish needs. It's
Yeah.
the circle of life.
We definitely have, I guess, built up some skills that will help us with that. I feel like the organization, the thinking about accessibility when you go places, like with dementia as well, I guess, like managing where somebody needs to go and being in familiar surroundings and all of those kind of things that are very relevant when you're looking after a child with certain needs. It's like whether we can find hours more time in the day. That's another matter.
What I really liked from the episode is Rachel making me realize that self-care doesn't have to be like a specific carved out time of the day or the week or whatever. It could be just finding little joys in life, you know, small things, listening to a piece of music, or like Rachel does, making sure that she has a slice of pizza from her favorite pizza store. We forget to do those little things. Our eyes are constantly looking at the bigger picture and not living in the moment.
Yeah, I agree.
It was a really eye-opening conversation. Enjoy.
This is the Fucking Normal Podcast. The cheers, tears, and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Our guest today is Rachel Pierce, who is originally from New York, but has been in the UK for more than 20 years now. She is an employment lawyer who works as a head of responsible business for RPC, a commercial city law firm, as well as the firm's in-house employment council. She's mother to almost 9-year-old Amelia and lives in London with her husband, Amelia's dad, Peter. Amelia has a mutation on her gene ARHGEF9, and with this has learning disabilities, autism, low muscle tone, hypertonia, and hypermobility.
6 years ago, when Amelia was 3 and Rachel was seeking a diagnosis for her, she faced another significant curveball in her life. Her father became ill with cancer and dementia. And as if that wasn't shocking and challenging enough, having those two parallel diagnoses going on, her mother, younger than her father, whom she had thought healthier of the two and able to care for her father, received a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And as their only child, Rachel was catapulted into finding ways to care for both her ailing parents remotely, making regular US trips at the very same time as coming to terms with her daughter's diagnosis and caring for her in the UK. In Rachel's own words, she felt like she was competing in the caring Olympics. She eventually and fortuitously took the decision to move her parents into a home just before COVID lockdown struck, and has now established a team of helpers in the USA to make this work. But as Rachel would describe, it hasn't always been so smooth, and it's taken a long time to get there. So hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Competing in the caring Olympics. How is everything going for you at the moment? How's Amelia?
It's like competing in the Olympics, but somebody tells you the day before you're competing in the Olympics.
You haven't got the training.
Thank you for having me. I'm well, thanks. And Amelia's really good. She's, I feel like she gets sort of funnier and cheekier and more imaginative every day. She's absolutely amazing. She's currently into Barbie and games on her iPad. Hide and seek is a big favorite, and usually kind of acting out pretend stories, usually involving her being a pop star.
Nice.
I love that.
Living my inner childhood dreams.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
Do you get to be a backup singer or
Or do you just
occasionally
watch?
I mean, I try and follow the steps, but usually I get them wrong. So but yeah, sometimes I'm security, you know, I take different roles.
I love that.
Very much like life.
Yes.
Can we just step back and get the context and the timeline? So what first kind of made you feel like you needed to do these investigations for Amelia? Take us through that, as well as then what happened with your parents.
Of course. So you try not to compare your child to others, but, you know, the other babies around kind of 9 months, you know, you start to notice they're becoming much more physical. They can start to crawl, and some of them were even sort of toddling around. And she just seemed to really struggle. I mean, she wasn't remotely kind of crawling, hated tummy time, wasn't standing. And I went back to the GP a number of times, probably about 4 or 5 times, to say, I'm concerned. I think there's something that's not quite right. And each time I got fobbed off as a sort of tiger mummy, you know, like, calm down, you're just a new neurotic mother, you know, they all develop at different rates. But I just sort of had this feeling in my gut that there was something not quite right. And I mean, I had no idea what it was, but obviously, you know, I wanted to try and find a way to support her. It wasn't until her 12-month health visitor check, actually, that catapulted us into the world of the NHS and all of the investigations, because she scored a 0 out of 60 on her gross motor skills test in that development check. That was actually just after the health visitor suggested that any developmental delays might have been my fault, that I wasn't stimulating
her
enough.
We hear this so much. It's terrible.
Yeah.
You feel like you failed the test.
It's definitely on me. Yeah.
That's awful.
So we got referred to a community pediatrician. Again, I just sort of thought, my husband and I both, I think, sort of just thought like, oh, well, my mother used to be a ballet dancer. So I thought, oh, maybe she's just a bit hypermobile. She'll just be really flexible. And she'll go on to
be a ballerina.
Really ballerina. Yeah. And we were quite surprised at that first pediatrician's appointment, because then the pediatrician sort of reeled off a whole list of quite terrifying sounding conditions that it sort of could be. We didn't have any sort of feeling like it might at any point be that serious. I think we'd kind of gone in thinking, oh, she might need a bit of light physio. Right. You know, and they just are like, well, it could be this, it could be that. And you're like, oh, okay, that's brand new information.
So you did feel kind of like blindsided by her potential diagnosis.
I think that was quite a shock, because, yeah, you sort of get thrust into, especially when you get into the sort of, I like to sort of say, like the upper echelons of the NHS. So when you're seeing like the big celebrity type doctors who are, you know, they come in with their teams of people and they're all very intimidating. You just never really expect to be there.
Gold card membership.
Yeah, absolutely. you get sort of to see people whose job titles you didn't even know kind of existed. We did the usual sort of, you know, all the investigations, all the tests, lots of speech and physiotherapy and all different things. And then finally got referred to the genetic side of things. And that's when they discovered her mutation. Yeah, then it's fun, because then you get to Google what it is, which is like reading another language.
Good old Google.
I know. In Amelia's case, it's quite a rare condition. It doesn't have a sort of official name. We're on a sort of Facebook group with other families around the world, which is quite fascinating. And it is a mutation on the X chromosome. So it tends to affect boys more severely than girls. And yeah, it causes sort of a number of challenges.
Processing and going through all of this, as we all know, is a very difficult time in our lives. Just that curveball, and not quite how you saw your journey of parenthood working out. So then what happened at this period in your life relating to your parents?
So my mother actually had Parkinson's diagnosed before my father, but it was very mild, and so it wasn't really that debilitating, I would say, for a number of years. So she was really active in her retirement and actually really like on the ball in terms of all the sort of self-care you're meant to do. So for Parkinson's, it's a neurological condition, and it's known sort of traditionally through the tremor is the sort of most commonly, I think, identified side effect. But it affects everything. I mean, speech and movement and thinking and swallowing and all different kind of things. But she was doing all the right things to do, lots of exercise, lots of kind of Mediterranean diets, all sorts. My dad then had a fall and fractured a vertebrae in his spine and was then sort of bedbound for about 9 months, kind of recovering from that break. And I think that was probably when his health really started to deteriorate and the symptoms of his dementia sort of started to surface. And at the time, we didn't know it was dementia, but we definitely could tell there were some difficult and challenging behaviors emerging. And so slowly, my mom wound up having to kind of drop all of her personal care to sort of care for him. I was traveling back and forth to try and bring in sort of different aids and resources and things to help and, you know, trying to kind of patch things up. But inevitably, you kind of then come home and, you know, a month later, it's moved on again. And so you need to go back and kind of address the latest sort of situation. It was starting to be a bit of a juggle, I would say, as my dad wound up struggling more and more, and then my mum stopped doing all the things that you do to kind of keep your Parkinson's under control.
Gosh, then what happened with your parents?
So then, yeah, my dad wound up having a number of falls after that. He was quite sort of weak and unsteady on his feet, and one fall in particular led to him breaking his hip, and that was kind of the crisis point, I suppose, where he wound up in hospital. He had to have an emergency hip replacement. And I think from what I understand with people who have dementia, as soon as you kind of take them out of their familiar surroundings, they stop being able to kind of fake it. So he was completely discombobulated, you know, new surroundings, busy hospital, general anesthetic doesn't really do great things for people on the older end of the spectrum. Yeah, he couldn't hide his dementia anymore. It was quite clear. So he never returned home. He went to rehab, and my parents had 6 months apart, which they found really difficult.
What was that like? I mean, I think for us as parents of special needs, when you get your initial diagnosis, it can be incredibly overwhelming. But then to have not only that, but then also be dealing with your parents.
It's funny because when you're in it, you're just sort of like, well, this is just my life. So I'll just sort of try and make the best of, you know, a difficult time. And obviously I didn't know sort of at that time how long it was going to go on for or kind of what we were dealing with. I mean, Amelia, we were probably, you know, doing investigations for her for about 2 years before we had a diagnosis. So part of my parents' journey was sort of overlapping with Amelia's, you know, kind of investigations and therapies rather than kind of having a diagnosis. So it was sort of a bit of a sort of slow burner in a way, because it was, you know, as I said, a bit of an evolution, and so probably helps get your brain wrapped around what's going on. That being said, it has been quite intense at times. Definitely I was before COVID flying back and forth to New York probably every month or two and trying to do lots of appointments for Amelia and trying to get to kind of the bottom of some of the things we were seeing with her and trying to hold down a full-time job.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that one.
There were a few hats being swapped quickly around. So yeah, it was definitely a very overwhelming time.
What was your employer like at that time? Because I feel sometimes they can be really, really understanding and other times not so.
I have been incredibly lucky, actually. So my firm and my kind of immediate manager have both been really brilliant, really flexible, really supportive and kind of empathetic. and gave me the space and the trust to kind of work how I needed to work. So if I needed to kind of go to a hospital appointment, or if I needed to kind of go to New York for a long weekend or something, I just worked as I needed to. And if anything, it made me want to work harder to sort of show that their trust in me wasn't sort of mislaid. And, you know, it's kind of really prove that it was fine and I could manage it. I just needed to sort of have a bit of space at certain times. I was just so incredibly grateful because it felt like quite a vulnerable time for me when I was sort of having to juggle lots of different things that, frankly, you can't deprioritize. They're your family. So that's actually been a really positive.
Was it your decision to put them in the care home, or was that something that your mother and you decided on, or was that pressure from the doctors? How did that work? How did you come to that decision?
So just before the end of 2019, my mum took the decision to move into a care home with my dad. He went into the memory care unit, which is a sort of secure unit for people with dementia. And she has a sort of assisted living apartment the floor above, where she has aides who help her with her daily needs. I've always sort of tried to take, you know, a sort of supportive backseat with them. So I try and be as respectful as possible of their independence and their decision making. I never want to kind of go in and be like, right, this is how it's going to be done. I know best. It was my mum who found it really difficult. She was in the apartment in New York alone. Dad was in this rehab place. She was finding it really exhausting traveling out to see him regularly. He was struggling without her. It's actually a very beautiful love story. So it was actually her decision, and I kind of helped as much as I could in terms of, you know, scoping out possible care homes in the area and you know, visiting them with her. And
that does make it slightly easier.
Yeah.
I mean, so you're processing things at either end of the spectrum, and I just can't imagine what that must have been like. Definitely feel when you have a child, any child, when you have children, you start to, it starts to bring in you to focus your parental relationships, and you reflect back on how your parents brought you up and your child state and all the rest of it. Obviously there's a whole different kind of light potentially shone on that with a child that has a disability. And that likewise, as your parents are getting older and unwell, it must have felt like quite a period of huge change in terms of sense of loss around your parents as well. And that will obviously make one reflect. So you're doing these things which really bring kind of focus to your parental relationships. How was that? Does it feel like similar things were happening in parallel?
I mean, yeah, things are definitely happening in parallel. There were definitely some kind of common themes. It sort of felt like I was just jumping from here, there and everywhere, to be honest. It felt quite frantic. That's kind of my strongest memory of it back then, especially because with my parents, it always felt like on the edge of a crisis at any moment, because their needs were increasing. And especially with my dad, he was having so many falls and his behavior was challenging. We were having to call ambulances weekly pretty much before he had his big fall. So it always felt like it was sort of living on the edge, really, and not kind of in the fun way. but it was, yeah, a lot of limbo as well, I would say, was one of the common themes. I mean, I found Amelia's diagnosis actually quite liberating, because I finally knew what I was feeling all along, which was that there wasn't, you know, something that was the same as the other children. That's no bad thing, but it's, you know, you sort of don't know what you don't know until, you know. And so actually I found the diagnosis actually really reassuring and relaxing in a way, because I thought, okay, now I know what we're dealing with. Cool. We can make a plan. And, you know, I don't deal well, I think, with the unknowns and the gray area, the gray space. And, you know, you always sort of go to catastrophizing the worst possible scenarios. And actually, it's never like that, really.
You felt vindicated.
Yeah. So, I mean, and my parents were kind of similar in terms of, you know, you just never really quite knew what was next. No one can really tell you what's going to happen tomorrow or in a month's time, or, you know, what the best thing is. One of the challenges of being an only child is that as they wound up being less able to make decisions for themselves, that fell more onto my shoulders, which is I see it as a huge responsibility. You know, you want to kind of do right by your parents, and, you know, even in the end of life should be as hopefully as joyful and kind of happy as possible. And obviously that becomes more challenging as you have health conditions, but yeah, you want to kind of do the right thing. So it's hard because you're kind of on your own trying to navigate all of those things in your head.
Did you define yourself as a carer? Do you define yourself as a carer for Amelia as well as your parents?
Yeah, I probably do. I think, I certainly care for, I think everyone really. I mean, Amelia hopefully will go on to care for me one day and bring me lots of martinis in my old age. But yeah, my parents, I mean, I manage all of their affairs. I'm power of attorney, and, you know, everything kind of sits with me now pretty much. And of course I, you know, defer to them as and when I can do and it's appropriate and safe too. But yeah,
it struck me just when you were talking about making sure that your parents, you know, that you didn't march in and just kind of make the decisions, it's obviously when you're caring for a child it's quite different, because then their capacity to make those decisions at a young age, like any child, is very, very limited. But it's obviously as Amelia gets older, it's almost like then you start to think about their autonomy and their decision making in that process. So I guess you've experienced that already with your parents, and a lot of us may also experience that at the other end of the spectrum. It must have been incredibly hard to prioritize everybody's different needs. How, when you had to travel back and forth to the States, what was the impact on Amelia of you having to do that?
That was probably that's probably been the hardest piece of it. I mean, aside from obviously, you know, the emotional piece of coming to terms with your parents aging and becoming unwell, of course, is super hard. But the travel was tough. I'd love to be in two places or more at the same time. And so the inability to not be able to kind of split myself into two or clone myself was a real sort of difficulty, I think, because, you know, I would love to be in New York more and be with my parents more and be able to support them in real life IRL. But yeah, every time I travel, it's really hard on Amelia and me. I miss her terribly. And, you know, and I know she finds that difficult when I'm gone for periods of time. And so you do always just feel like you're never quite doing enough in any particular place. You sort of spread too thin. And I know, you know, I'm sure lots of people feel like that. It's even just working and parenting and, you know, it's that classic parent guilt, isn't it? Where you sort of want to be in two places at once, but this was sort of wanting to be in three or more. So yeah, that's been the hardest. I mean, not, you know, and not to mention, it's just really tiring traveling internationally that regularly with the time difference and then working. And yeah, I was doing some pretty brutal, like sort of 8 p.m. flights back to New York where you land at 11 p.m. It feels like 5 in the morning. You've got 3 days to kind of run around, get a million things done, and then I catch a red eye flight back and work the next day, and it's just absolutely exhausting.
Oh my god,
that is horrible. It sounds like you talked about it before, you don't like gray area or unexpected, you'd like a plan. It sounds like you had to kind of, well, you must have had to organize the shit out of things to make things work. Was that a coping mechanism to kind of throw yourself into it, like you maybe have done in a work scenario?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, probably to my detriment a little bit. I think I probably used being really busy as almost a crutch and a coping strategy. So, you know, it's really difficult, especially when it goes on for a long period of time. You can't just constantly be emoting. You know, it's sort of you sort of have to kind of get quite good at compartmentalizing things just so you can get through your day and do what you need to do. And so I think that's been a challenge in terms of doing that in a measured way so that you still are processing some of what you're feeling as at the same time as sort of trying to kind of get things done. And, you know, certainly with my parents, I've inherited two other people's personal admin, which I mean is crazy because I can barely keep on top of my own. But, you know, so there is logistical stuff that, you know, and it is busy that you have to do. But yeah, I definitely use busyness, I think, as a way to kind of not have to deal with things. And then that just kind of led to me burning out, really, trying to burn the candle at every possible end. Some of us perfectionist kind of control freaks, you know, they're like, I'm going to do caring really, really well. I'm going to be the best at caring. and so, yeah.
Yeah. You had a lot of, you were competing in a lot of events. So, you know, you had a good chance at that gold medal.
I was. It's a sport where you do like 10 different, in athletics. Is it the
Decathlon, triathlon. Yeah.
Decathlon.
Millionathlon.
Yeah, pretty much. Just spinning a lot of plates. So, yeah, I think it's a slippery slope. You have to, I mean, busy is good and can help. And it is just realistically busy. But I think you have to kind of keep an eye on it as well, because it can also, it can start driving you rather than the other way around.
Yeah. Did you get to a point where you just realized, I can't do this anymore. I need some help. Like, what was the light bulb moment? Was it something that had happened, you know, in terms of Amelia's care or your parents? But was there a moment in that period where you were like, I've had enough. I cannot physically be in a million places. I cannot keep spinning these plates.
I had a period of burnout, which, I mean, I didn't sort of, it wasn't like me making a decision about it. I probably should have done earlier, but yeah, that was probably my body just being like, no, thank you. We are done now. So I took 3 weeks off of work. Work were really nice about it and really supportive. And I just tried to spend that time. I did a lot of therapy and I did a lot of running and just tried to kind of really focus on getting myself a little bit clearer in my head around how I was going to deal with all of this. And, you know, and part of that is talking about practicalities of care and help and, you know, hacks around how to make things a bit easier, find shortcuts and things. And part of it is actually, and I did this obviously with the help of the therapist, but kind of finding ways to give yourself a bit more compassion and permission to not do everything to the best possible degree all the time, because it's frankly impossible. So, you know, just kind of getting happy with things being good enough sometimes, and that's okay because you're just one person.
Yeah, there's the giving yourself compassion and a break. There's also recognizing the emotional turmoil that and processing that. So it sounds like that you were so head on in the, I'm going to care the shit out of everything and deal with everything in a like uber organized way, that you didn't maybe give yourself space for processing what was going on both ends of the spectrum.
No, definitely. I didn't. And I mean, you know, it's not a comfortable, you know, it's not a comfortable place to be. It's not like you really want to sit around and process feelings of, you know, grief and a set whatever else, but you know, you kind of have to. And and certainly, you know, as I mean, as you watch parents get older and kind of come to sort of more of an end of life stage, you know, it's something that's unfortunately a kind of inevitability about having to kind of cope with that stage of things. And it is, it's tough, but I think it's going to come whether you're open to it or not. So you kind of have to just get there however you can. So you can't really go around it.
Yeah.
It's hard because parents of disabled children, not only are you grieving your parents getting older and that inevitability of death on that end, but you're also grieving, I certainly did, grieving the life that you had imagined that you would have as a mother, because it's been thrown in the furnace and burned because it's just not what you had imagined at all. So there, you must have been going through two different types of grief at the same time, which must have been so incredibly overwhelming.
Absolutely. Sort of, you know, you envisage certain things for life as like, right, when I'm this age, I'll have these things and I'll have this relationship, you know, whatever. And certainly as a parent, you never want any barriers or hurdles put in your child's way. You want the world to be their oyster. You want them to have every door open. As a child, you know, with your parents having to sort of flip the roles and become parent to your parents is not, it's not a natural place to be, and it's uncomfortable as well. There's a sort of, yeah, you definitely kind of feel a sort of loss as well in terms of, you know, I mean, I think my mom would have loved to have more time as a grandmother with Amelia, which I feel really sad for both of them, frankly, for missing that time. So yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, is what it is, but it's not what you pictured.
What's the relationship like between Amelia and your parents?
So the last time we were all there, she was there with us, was in 2019. So actually we went over for my father's birthday when he was in hospital recovering from his hip replacement. Yeah, so she was there, she was four, and then COVID hit. She hasn't been back since, but hopefully we'll get back again soon. I mean, my dad's not so great with tech anymore, but with my mom, we still FaceTime and, you know, try and do the odd virtual dance party. So yeah, they have.
A...
Yeah, she knows and loves her grandma Sue.
That's beautiful. That's, I mean, beautiful. It was just reminding me, my story is very, very different to yours, but my husband's mom, so my mother-in-law, has dementia, and every so often she comes to stay with us and we take on the care so that it's not all falling to his brother and sister. And one of the things that I find quite beautiful when she's here is she's in the moment, of course, because her short-term memory is shot. So it's, you know, everything is kind of the here and now, or reminiscing about a long, long time ago. And as adults, I think we find that quite hard to, you know, remember in conversation and not go into that short-term memory bit. But with B, her life is 100% in the moment as well, you know, it's like right now. So the way that they interact, it's actually rather beautiful. It's just, you know, they don't necessarily understand each other all the time, but it's just filled with love and in moment time. Yeah. Which is is a good lesson for us,
yeah,
all,
I
guess.
I think, I mean, some of the flip side of it, I think, is you get a glimpse into like this totally alternative universe. And certainly, like, you know, when you get a diagnosis for your child, I have learned so much more about all sorts of aspects of her world that I had no clue about. And now I'm better for it. And similarly, you know, you get to, I think, celebrate different things. So it's not, I think, and I'm trying to look at it in a, it's not less, it's different. So it's, you know, I look at my parents, like my dad's not really particularly verbal anymore, but he and my mom sometimes go to concerts together at their care home and they just hold hands and like smile at each other, and it's literally the sweetest thing you've ever seen. But you know, you almost kind of don't need much more than that always. Sometimes you can just have quite a beautiful moment in something really small.
The purest moment.
Yeah, it's really pure. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, they just see each other and you can see, like, you know, my dad doesn't remember much at all, but he remembers my mom still, and his face lights up when he sees her, and it's just like, oh, come on, guys.
That is so
bad.
The body feels what the mind can't necessarily process. That's amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And how are things now? You sound like in a much better place than obviously things were.
Yes, definitely. I'm out of limbo a little bit more, which is a happy place for me. Amelia's doing great. She's the light of my life and absolutely just incredible and such a strong little character. I love it. It's great kind of watching her grow and experience the world. And my parents, I mean, you know, it's sort of beautiful and sad, I guess. So my dad's now in hospice care, and he's still kind of stable, but there's a bit of limbo there still because you don't know what's coming next. We don't really know how much longer he has. Just trying to kind of go back over a little bit more at the moment just to see him. But it feels like I've kind of come to terms a bit more with the situation. It doesn't mean it's not sad anymore, but I kind of accept a little bit more of what's happened. I think as well, the relief too, in that I know that they're in a good care home, so they have the care that they need. And I know they're safe. I know they're healthy. I know if there's an issue, it's picked up. You know, all of those kinds of things are in hand. So that's a real reassurance for me.
What about you?
Who?
How have you managed to find space for yourself? And how have you been able to delegate what to kind of let go of, but not let go of, but pass up that baton of responsibility to somebody else?
I think there's truth in like it takes a village, both I think on any end of the caring spectrum. Obviously in this kind of global world we're living in, you know, we don't have our usual home village anymore, so you kind of have to like befriend a village, pay for a village, or you know, beg for a village or whatever you need to do, but you need to find your little crew. I mean, in New York, like there's some very practical logistical challenges that I have that I need help with. So, you know, I can't be there to open their mail. I can't be there to go to the drugstore and fill a prescription. It's incredibly complicated when I, you know, if we need to make a doctor's appointment and you have to arrange transport and you have to arrange an escort and you have to arrange a million different things. So I have people in New York who can help me with that. Some are friends and some are people who I've hired. I mean, there's literally no way you could do it all yourself. And I think that acknowledgement is the starting point. Otherwise, I mean, I think I've gotten better over the years through trial and error, probably. At trying to prioritize, you know, my own, like it's a cliche, of course, but you know, you absolutely cannot pour from an empty cup, and it's essential to care for yourself when you're caring for other people. So it's not a selfish act. It's just a necessity. And it's something that makes you more able to be a carer. So I do try and prioritize things. I have a wonderfully supportive husband, which I'm very lucky to have. He and I share the load and juggle. And so if I want to go and do a run or whatever, then, you know, we share that.
But has it been an impact on work going forward?
I work 4 days a week now. So I've dropped a day. So I try and almost compartmentalize the admin. The New York admin, it's my New York admin day, and that's that day, and then I don't have to kind of think about it the rest of the week.
So Rachel, through all that, having experienced so much, is there anything that you have learnt or wish that you had known, or some insight that you might be able to pass on to somebody who's going through something similar to you?
Yeah, definitely. And obviously I put a big caveat on that because I recognize fully that I'm coming from a place of privilege in terms of, you know, the fact that I have a supportive employer and I have a supportive husband and I have the ability to sometimes hire the help that I need if I need it. So take it all with a pinch of salt. It's just my kind of personal experience. But for anybody, kind of organization, as you kind of mentioned earlier, is really essential. And even like the really kind of boring bit, you know, like with parents, you know, get estate documents in order, get your powers of attorney done, you know, if there's DNRs or health proxy forms, take copies of like important ID and insurance cards or anything like that, because I found that, you know, all of a sudden I was having to make decisions on things, and sometimes you need people's details.
That's so true.
So practical.
It's very practical. Yeah.
I guess on the other end of the spectrum with Amelia and with our children, we're setting all of that stuff up from scratch from day dot, you know, seeing it a different version of being a carer coming down the other end of the line. It's really important.
But I'm sure lots of parents, I mean, even, you know, lots of parents of neurotypical children do probably have whole files and folders of their kids, you know, of all the different sort of categories of their child, you know, like important documents, they've got medical things, they've got, you know, activities, all sorts of things. And it's kind of similar, but maybe a little bit more depressing with estate planning and do not resuscitate orders. But, you know, it's sort of the same principle in terms of just, you know, having stuff to hand before you actually are in a place of really needing it. Because that's been really helpful. And it was a bit of advice that a family friend gave me, and she was absolutely right. I think as well, like, talk to friends or other family or neighbors or whoever you can kind of before it is a crisis situation, and kind of scope out who's willing to help and how they can help, because I think it's better to know who you can call on before you're actually in a moment where you're just frantic and, or, you know, there's sort of not enough time or whatever else. I think it's better to kind of have your phone of friends kind of identified earlier. On both sides of the spectrum, I think caring is often pretty synonymous with advocacy. And so expect to have to battle and question and push and follow up. You know, you do, no matter who you're looking after, have to sort of stay on top of all the detail and one step ahead. So, you know, you're constantly pushing things forward.
What about for
me?
Yeah. What about you? Looking after yourself.
I was coming to that. Yeah, I think carve out time for yourself however you can. And I think, I mean, what I've learned actually on this journey is try and be a bit more kind of conscious or mindful or like sort of specific around where you can find something enjoyable. And I know that's not always possible, but like, I mean, when I go back to New York, you know, sometimes it's a really difficult trip, but I always make sure I go to my favorite pizza place. And I know it's like a really small thing, but I really enjoy their pizza. And just for like that 10, 15 minutes when I'm there, it's just quite pleasing and happy. So,
and you know, live in the moment. So you don't think about anything else.
Find the moment. Exactly. Yeah. Find that little bit of joy somewhere.
Self-care is the pizza you like.
Absolutely. Sometimes it is just a really cheesy pizza. Whatever it is, find the sort of things that can make it a little bit more enjoyable. And sometimes it's more just having an appreciation for someone. Sometimes it's having a joke with somebody and just have, you know, just be really kind of almost present and cognizant of that moment. I just went back to New York in the end of November, and you know, it was a really hard trip. It was the first time I saw my dad after he'd been moved into hospice care, but we just had a really nice smile at each other. And even just that, I was like, I'm just going to take a kind of real picture of this in my head so I can go back to it in future. And it doesn't negate the difficulty of the trip, but it's just a nice other side of it. And I think expect people to surprise you in all different ways. Sometimes people will, who you expect won't, will possibly disappoint you, but other people really amazingly rise to the occasion and are like your essentially new village and your new family. Sometimes people won't understand. Sometimes people will ask really silly questions. Sometimes people feel totally uncomfortable. And there's a sort of whole range of responses that you kind of have to get used to responding to. And that might be the new normal, and that's kind of okay. You know, you have to sort of just evolve with it and roll with it. But I think it's key to sort of know who your people are, who kind of show up.
Yeah, amen. That's so
beautiful
true.
Advice. So
gosh,
good.
You've been through a lot. I'm still going through a lot, and I really appreciate you coming on The Fucking Normal and, you know, sharing with such candor your experience and that emotional, oh, I don't like to use the word journey, but that emotional path that you have found yourself on. So thank you. It's been really lovely chatting, and I hope that we'll next time do it over a few beers. Either you come North London or we're coming South London. We need to make this work.
Yes, we do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Amazing. But before we go, as we always end the podcast with a fucking normal. So, Rachel Pierce, what is your fucking normal?
So my fucking normal, so I think I alluded to this at the beginning of our conversation, but I mentioned that Amelia is currently loving being a pop star at the moment. And so my fucking normal is most mornings on the way to school, when we kind of park the car and walk to school, I have to pretend to be a security guard and have to make sure I'm rolling out the red carpet and throwing rose petals for her and managing the paparazzi and managing her fans, her overzealous fans who are looking for an autograph. So that is currently my fucking normal.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I look forward to her first, her debut album.
I mean, we all do. It's in production.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Love that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We're part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.